All right, what we just started by you loading those gels is a basic separation technique used a lot in science. It's called electrophoresis. It's just one of many separation techniques used in science. What other separation techniques are there? We've talked about at least one. No guesses? Makes for a long recording. What are some other separation techniques besides electrophoresis? Like in the experiment with the viruses, what did they use to separate things? Yes. How did they separate the contents of the tube? Centrifugation. That's a separation technique based on differences in mass, right? Heavier things go to the bottom, lighter things are pushed to the top.
I thought that was going to be on the exam.
Well, it's a basic separation technique, so it's important in science whether it was on the exam or not. Distillation is another. This is how you make booze, right? You start with fermenting something using organisms that ferment, but that'll make it only so high in alcohol content because the alcohol builds up and that kills the cells that are fermenting. So to make booze, which is much stronger, you then ferment that solution. Fermentation is separation based on different boiling points. You slowly heat it up and the stuff that's easiest to boil comes off first and you collect that and so on. Another one is chromatography, which is kind of similar to electrophoresis because something moves through a medium. We don't do it in here, but you've probably accidentally done chromatography when you were a kid. Have you ever been painting with watercolors and spilled a drop of paint on a napkin? And when you look 5-10 minutes later, you see it come out as a rainbow, kind of? That's because whatever color it is really a mixture of different colored molecules. And they move at different speeds through the napkin, so it separates the colors out. Electrophoresis is kind of similar to that. And it is separation based on three different things. It separates things based on electrical charge, positive and negative charges, also based on size of the particles, and also based on shape of the particles. So you use this, well, let me say something before that. Those three things all determine how things move through the gel. But importantly, if your mixture of whatever particles you have, if none of those particles has any charge, if they're all neutral, then you need to look elsewhere for a separation technique. Because there is no tendency for something that has no charge to move in an electrophoresis gel when you expose it to a voltage. Okay? So electrophoresis is used to separate charged particles, but size, you know, assuming that there is charge in at least some of them, they'll separate, and the size and the shape will determine how much they separate and how quickly they separate from each other. So electrophoresis uses a gel as the medium called the electrophoresis gel. That's what you've been working with. Jesus, just as worthless. I guess these are the good ones. The gel is the rectangular thing you just loaded your samples in. And that was already made for you. And notice that the wells were at one end of the gel. You don't have to make it that way. You can make the wells anywhere you want. You really, it's just like making gelatin, really. Except it uses a polysaccharide made from algae. But it sets up just like gelatin. And so it's liquid at first. And while it's still liquid in your mold, you put in what's called a comb, because it has a bunch of little fingers on it. And you stick that comb into the liquid, and it will set up around that, and then you pull that comb out, and that's how you have the wells. So you can put the wells at one end like they are in this one, or you could have them in the middle, like right here. Those are wells. It depends on what you're separating. If you have a mixture, and you know that there are some charged particles in there, which there have to be in order for electrophoresis to work, but you don't know whether they're positively charged or negatively charged, or there might be both negative particles and positive particles, then you would want to have your wells in the middle of the length of the well, of the gel. And that's because you're going to apply a voltage. One end is going to be negatively charged, the other end is going to be positively charged. And therefore, if a negatively charged particle is in your sample and therefore put into the well, it's going to be attracted to the positive end because opposite charges attract. So it's going to go downward in this, but a positively charged one's going to go toward the negative end. And you want to put the wells in the middle because they'll go in both directions. We didn't do that, though. We put them all the wells at the one end. And that's because we know what our samples are. Our samples are all different from each other, but they are all made out of DNA, right? It's owl DNA. And you needed enough to get visible results in this experiment. That's why last week you used a very small amount of owl DNA and amplified it many millions of times by using PCR. So that there would be a lot of copies in your sample. But it's all DNA, even though it's different versions of DNA, it doesn't matter. All DNA, no matter what organism you take it out of, has a negative charge. Why is it that DNA is negatively charged? What makes all DNA negative? The phosphates that are a part of each nucleotide, and there are thousands or millions of nucleotides in each piece of DNA. So it doesn't matter how long the DNA is, it's going to be negative because every monomer that's stuck together, it has a negative charge in it. Therefore, we put the wells all at one end, and I could have messed this experiment up if I put the gel in the chamber incorrectly. If I had this upside down, and I put the wells down at the positive end, the negative DNA is going to be attracted to the positive, and that would make it just spill right off of the edge. But instead, I put the wells at the negative end, DNA is negative, and it's going to move toward the positive end. This gives it the full gel as room to move through the, or electrophorese through the gel. Okay? So, really, an electrophoresis trial, which we're in the middle of, is kind of like a race. Your sample is potentially multiple different kinds of particles. Now, there will be millions and millions of copies, but you could have different kinds of particles in that sample, right? Which would be like different people running a race. But you start at the same place, at the starting line. They're all going to move at different speeds, though, the different kinds of particles. Even though they're all going the same direction, that's because of the charge. They're going to go at different speeds based on their shape and their size. If you think about shape first, electrophoresis is kind of like walking through a swimming pool, which is a lot harder than walking through air, right? You can walk through a swimming pool, but it slows you down a lot. And if you make your body as spread out as possible while you're in deep water, it's going to be even harder to walk. So that's why shape matters. But size also matters. Larger things are going to get hung up more as they try to move through the medium. So, it might seem counterintuitive, so make sense of this. If you have two particles moving in the same direction, but they're different sizes, the larger one is going to be slower. The DNA, if you were to look at that gel right now, you wouldn't see any bands, as they're called. But we'll see bands once we expose it to ultraviolet radiation, which is what the machine I turned on is allowing us to do. The bands are there, they're just not visible yet until you shine UV on it. But what I'm saying is that if you have two different sized particles in a well, they're at the same position to start with, the larger ones are going to go slower, and therefore in the same amount of time they're not going to get as far. So you'd have a band there, and then the smaller ones would have a band farther down. Right? Because they're smaller and moving faster. That's the basis of the separation. You just run this long enough so that they separate from each other enough that you can tell them apart. But one band is not a single particle. If you had one piece of DNA, it would still be invisible to your naked eye, even though it's there in the well. And that's why you used PCR. You made millions of copies. They're all exactly the same speed since they're identical. And so one band really represents millions of copies all moving at the same speed. But it'll be a visible band. Okay? That's in general what you do with electrophoresis. For whatever reason you want to separate particles, and it doesn't have to be DNA, it just is for our case. Now, specifically with this owl DNA, what we're trying to answer in this example experiment today is what the sex of the owl was that you took the DNA from. The reason that works is because female birds have two different sex chromosomes, just like male humans do. But in birds, female have the two different sex chromosomes, a Z and a W, and males have two of the same sex chromosomes, like female humans do. Right? A ZZ versus a ZW. Since males have two of the same chromosome, that means if you had a male, all of your pieces of DNA are going to be the same size. And so you would get only one band for that. A female, though, has one slightly bigger piece of DNA and one slightly smaller. So you'll get two bands like I just drew here. Alright. Now you can see this in your manual on page 147. But actually 146 shows you a schematic of male and female. Notice that the male has two larger pieces and the female has a large and a small. So a male's going to have one band, but where is it going to be compared to these two? If the male has two large and a female has a large and a small, where's the band for a male going to be? It's going to be on the top one only. Same, it'll go the same distance as a female large one will, because it's the same version as in a female. She just has one of them, though, plus a smaller one that goes faster and farther. So that's really all we're looking for once we run this trial, is to figure out whether for each of your samples it was male or female based on whether there are two or one but it's also just a demo of electrophoresis. Now, the loading dye, which is the orange stuff, serves a couple purposes, a couple of which are mentioned in the manual, but I want to mention something else. As I said before, you can't see any DNA as it's traveling through the gel, even though it's there. And that's because the gel itself has a chemical in it that makes the DNA glow wherever it is under UV. And this is just natural light, so we don't see any glowing. Since it's invisible, we don't know where it is at any given moment. And that's important because you want to run an electrophoresis gel long enough to get good separation, right? If you only run it for a couple minutes, even if they're going at different speeds, that might look like a single band because they don't separate very much. On the other hand, you don't want to run it too long because if you keep running it, the smallest band is going to go just right off the other end because you let it run too long. So in any given experiment, you really want to optimize it, run it as long as you can to get maximal separation. And this is where the loading dye comes in. The loading dye is made up of particles that are smaller than any of the fragments that your sample is going to have. And so the loading dye, which you can see in the gel, is actually winning the race. All of your samples are behind what's called the dye front. And if you look at that gel right now, you'll see that the orange has migrated toward the other end of the gel. But what I meant by winning the race is that all the DNA is somewhere between the orange dye front and the wells where they started. That allows you to run it until the dye front gets close to the end, and you can be sure, therefore, that you haven't spilled any of your sample off the other edge. That all make sense? All right. Now, that's really the basics for today. Do you want me to continue speaking, or should we just wait in silence for the trial to be over? I haven't talked long enough. What did you say? Well, we're not even really halfway done, but we're about half. I can talk about the exam. It's really just the same thing that I said last time. Once again, it's really important to check the effect of the exam that the exam had on your minimum required for a C, a B, or an A. And this exam 4 usually is the one that definitively tells you whether it's possible to get the grade you're wanting or not. An impossible grade is indicated in your summary and forecast scores, in your grade page, as a blank. If the minimum required for an A is a blank, that means it's mathematically impossible, because the minimum would be more than 100%, and you can't get more than 100%. If you have a blank in the minimum for an A, a B, and a C, it's not possible to pass. Because even 100 on exam 5 would still make your total score below 66. That's what that's the mathematics behind these minimum required for C, B, and A. All right? Now, the only thing that is not figured into that is the possibility of improvement on a retake. So definitely be sure that you click on the retake option on the Hoffman site and read that carefully. Yeah. I'd have to check, because it's all, I set it up long ago to be automatic. I didn't post it today, it just appeared today because of the date. So if it's not working yet, I'll make it work, but probably not until I get home. Okay. Anyway, make sure you click on that yellow button retake option and read that carefully. If you have a blank in the minimum required for a C, then the only way, and it might still be mathematically impossible, but the only way it could still be possible to pass would be if you make an improvement on the retake that you would take. Okay? And you won't know the math of that because I don't have that set up. In other words, what I'm saying is a blank in the minimum required for a C assumes that you would not do any better on a retake if you take it than you did the first time. And that's usually the case. Most people who opt for the retake really don't improve. Every once in a while, there's an improvement that's big enough to make a difference. But usually people get almost exactly the same score as they did the first time around.
Is any exam more
true? No.
Okay,
only the lowest.
The lowest?
Yeah.